I'm replacing today Stefania, so unfortunately she couldn't make it today, so I'm replacing her, and I'm here to give the last lecture in the Standard Model course. And yeah, if you have any questions during this lecture, please ask me. If there's anything that comes to your mind after the lecture, you can try to reach me either in my office, 477, or you can write me an email, so don't hesitate to contact me if you have any questions or comments about this lecture. So this lecture will have two parts. The first part will be basically a wrap-up of the neutrino oscillations that you heard about in the last lecture. And then in the second part will be about the Higgs and the so-called hierarchy problem. This is kind of an outlook of why we believe that there's actually physics beyond the Standard Model. Okay, but let's finish up with neutrino oscillations. And last time, yesterday, you heard about, or you learned about the probability that a neutrino with flavor A oscillates into a neutrino with flavor beta. And this is a lengthy expression. I just copied again that we have it written here on the blackboard. Delta alpha beta, a sum over the neutrino mass eigenstates. And then it goes as sine squared, and here's the differences of the mass squares of the neutrino mass eigenstates, L for E. And then there's a second term, which has to do with the P violation. Okay, and this J, this matrix J here, is given by elements of the PM and S matrix. Okay, so that you already had last time. And what I want to do now is I want to tell you a bit more details about this PM and S matrix. So in general, this PM and S matrix is a unitary 3x3 matrix. That transforms the mass eigenstates of neutrinos into the flavor eigenstates. And as a unitary 3x3 matrix, generically you would expect it to have 3 angles and 6 faces. However, as you know from the case in the quark sector or the CKM matrix, it is a unitary 3x3 matrix, but it doesn't have 3 angles and 6 physical faces. Some of these faces can be absorbed by redefinition of fields, and the same happens here in the case of the PM and S matrix. Not all of these 3 angles and 6 faces are physical. So in particular, some of these faces can be reabsorbed by redefinition of neutrino and lepton fields. So if the neutrinos are Dirac particles, then everything is completely analogous to the CKM case, to the quark mixing case. And in that case, you can absorb 5 of these faces by redefining the charged lepton and the neutrino fields. And so in that case, you can absorb 5 faces. If instead neutrinos are Majorana particles, in that case, you have less freedom to do this refacing. In particular, you cannot put any faces anymore into the neutrino fields, because refacing the neutrinos, if they're Majorana, would change the mass matrix itself, because the neutrino mass matrix, in the case they are Majorana, would have just this structure. So if you reface them, these mass eigenvalues would become suddenly complex. You're not allowed to reface the neutrino fields in case if they are Majorana, and then you can only absorb three faces, basically into the charged leptons. So depending on if they're Dirac or Majorana, this PMNS matrix has a different number of free parameters. And what one usually does is one writes down a standard parametrization of this matrix. So because one can do these refacings, because not all of these faces are physical, of course, there are many equivalent parametrizations of this matrix. But the standard parametrization that usually everybody uses is the following. So one writes it basically as a product of three rotation matrices to account for the three angles. So another 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then here a cosine of some mixing angle 2, 3. Sinus of a mixing angle 2, 3 minus sinus cosine times another rotation, which rotates between the first and the third generation. And then it's the usual parameterization is that one puts here one of these complex faces, delta Cp. And here it's a cosine again. And a rotation between the first and the second generation. So now I have already one face inside there. And if it's Majorana, there are two more faces. And the usual convention is to put them in that way. That is a standard parameterization for this PMNS matrix. So these faces here, these two faces, delta 1 and delta 2, they are called Majorana faces. They are only physical if the neutrinos are Majorana particles. If they are Dirac particles, these two faces can also be reabsorbed. This face here, this is a Dirac face. And this one is always physical. This leads to physical effects. And I should maybe write this. Of course, this Sij means sinus of some mixing angle ij, and Cij is the cosine of some mixing angle ij. So one thing you can convince yourself is that if you take this generic form, this standard parameterization of the PMNS matrix, and put it into this oscillation formula here, what you find is that these Majorana faces, they all drop out completely here. So these probabilities that neutrinos of different flavors oscillate into each other, they do not depend on these Majorana faces. That also means with neutrino oscillations, you're not able actually to distinguish if neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac. No matter which faces you put here, you will always get the same same probabilities for oscillations of different neutrino flavors. So with neutrino oscillations, you will be able to determine this first part of the PMS matrix. And if they are Dirac, if neutrinos are Dirac particles, it's actually everything you have to determine. So you can determine these three angles, and in principle also this Dirac phase, this pivoting phase, which sits inside there. And the way to do that is the following. So you basically want to do experiments which are able to measure these probabilities of neutrinos of a particular flavor oscillating into another flavor or staying in the same flavor. So what you ideally want to do is you want to have some neutrino source which gives you a neutrinos of a particular flavor with some particular energy, and then at various lengths, various distances from this neutrino source, you put your detectors, and then you measure these probabilities, these oscillation probabilities. In that way, you can determine, first of all, you can determine the differences of the mass squares, and you can also determine the various elements or the various parameters of the PMNS matrix. And just to give you a very brief idea with which type of experiments that one does to do that, so which type of neutrino sources one actually uses to do these experiments. One important source of neutrinos is the sun. So the sun produces a lot of electron neutrinos just in the fusion process that is happening in the sun. And one can model the spectrum of these electron neutrinos that come out from the sun. One has an idea of what the energy spectrum, the energy distribution of these electron neutrinos will be. And one also can model how much of these electron neutrinos come out of the sun. And then at the Earth, you put a detector, so the length, the distance there will be the distance between the Earth and the sun. And then you can measure how many of these electron neutrinos actually survived until the Earth, or if some of them oscillated into muon neutrinos or tau neutrinos. Another source of neutrinos would be cosmic rays that are hitting the atmosphere. So if cosmic rays hit the atmosphere, they produce a lot of stuff, so-called air showers, which contain many types of particles. In particular, they contain a lot of pions, so they produce a lot of pions, these cosmic rays, when they hit the atmosphere. And then pions decay. And you know how pions decay, so a pi plus decays into a mu plus and a mu neutrino. The mu plus will decay in a positron, an electron neutrino, and a muon antineutrino. And similar, if you have a pi minus, it will decay into a muon and a muon antineutrino, and then the muon will decay into electron, electron antineutrino, and a muon neutrino. You roughly produce the same amount of positive and negatively charged pions in this from these cosmic rays. So what then happens is that after this decays, you roughly have a ratio of muon neutrinos to electron neutrinos. It should be given roughly by two. So you produce two times more muon neutrinos than electron neutrinos in the atmosphere. And then you look down on the Earth, you look how many of these muon neutrinos and electron neutrinos actually survive, and you see if this ratio has changed while the neutrinos went from the atmosphere down to the Earth. By looking actually at different angles, different directions, if you look straight up or you look at the horizon, you actually can change the distance between your detector and the place where these cosmic rays were hitting the atmosphere. You can also actually change this distance and actually have some interesting measurements of these oscillation probabilities as a function, actually, even of the distance. Then another important way to measure these oscillations is to use neutrinos from nuclear reactors. Nuclear reactors produce a lot of electron antineutrinos from beta decay of the fission products. And what one usually does there is one puts a so-called far detector very close to the reactor, which measures the amount of electron antineutrinos which come out. Then you put a far detector several hundred kilometers away, which then measures how many of these electron antineutrinos survived, if some of them, how many of them stayed electron antineutrinos, or if they oscillated into another flavor. And very similar, there are also experiments which use dedicated neutrino beams. So at various accelerator facilities, you can actually produce neutrino beams. That basically happens such that you first start to produce a lot of pions or kaons, which then decay into which in the decay products have a lot of neutrinos. And you can actually produce these neutrino beams, and they mainly contain muon neutrinos and muon antineutrinos. And there again, you can do similar experiments as in case of, say, nuclear neutrinos. You put a near detector close to your source of neutrinos, and then a far detector far away, 100 kilometers away, and see how these muon neutrinos or muon antineutrinos have oscillated. And by doing so, by doing these experiments, we actually have a fairly accurate measurements of these elements of the PM&S matrix, and also accurate measurements of the differences of the mass squares of the neutrino masses. So what we know are these theta 1, 2, theta 2, 3, and also theta 1, 3, as well as the mass differences. And of course, there are only two independent mass differences. We have three masses, so two independent mass differences. Let's call it 3, 2. They are known roughly at the percent level. So the uncertainties on these parameters are at the percent level. They're actually fairly precise. There are also a few things that we actually don't know. And one thing is the p-routing phase, this delta Cp, this Dirac phase there. We don't know the value of this parameter. But in principle, it's as I said, these oscillation probabilities, if you look at the oscillation probability of a neutrino going into flavor alpha going to flavor beta, and then looking at the same probability for the antineutrinos, there's some difference. So I think that's what you also heard last time. This last term here changes the sign. So in principle, by measuring precisely the oscillation probabilities of neutrinos versus antineutrinos and comparing them, you are in principle able to be sensitive to this CP-routing phase, and you should be able to measure it. Just turns out that the experiments that are currently running don't have the sensitivity yet, don't have enough data yet in order to measure it, but it will eventually happen that we will have also a measurement of this delta Cp phase. Unless, of course, it turns out to be extremely tiny. If for some reason this turns out to be 0.01 or so, we won't measure it. But if it's an order one phase, we should be able to measure its value soon, actually. Another thing that we don't know is the ordering of the neutrino masses. So the neutrino mass hierarchy. So again, if one takes these oscillation probabilities, what one finds is that there's actually some degeneracy. So there are basically two equivalent solutions that give the same results for these oscillation probabilities. And the first situation would be something like that. I have the mass eigenstate 3 up here, 2 and 1. So there will be one mass difference, delta m 3, 2, and then the second one, delta m to 1, so it's a configuration like that, which is called the normal hierarchy. And then there's a second configuration, where the neutrino 3 is actually the lightest one. Oops, this should be 1. So here you have your delta m 2 1 here, and then you would have delta m 3 1 squared here. And so these two configurations, and the second configuration is called inverted hierarchy. And these two configurations essentially lead to the same predictions for the neutrino oscillation. So with the neutrino oscillation, it's very difficult to distinguish between these two scenarios. And it actually will probably take a long time in order to understand which of these situations is actually realized. In the simple way that I showed it here, I think that they cannot distinguish at all. So these are completely equivalent, I think, compared to this equation that is written there. Now that is not the full story, actually. If you do really experiments with these neutrinos, there are additional effects you have to take into account. There are effects, so-called meta effects. So if the neutrinos they pass through some material, they will interact with the material, and this will change these oscillation probabilities. Because these oscillation probabilities were assuming that they just propagate in vacuum without doing anything. But if they go through some material, they will interact, and this will change this story a bit. And neutrinos and antineutrinos, they will interact differently with matter. And that these modifications that you get to this oscillation expression, this oscillation formula up there, when you include this meta effect, when I can actually show that in that case, these two scenarios will lead to small differences, actually. So in the end, one will be able to distinguish them. One just needs a lot of data, a lot very precise experiments, which make use of these meta effects in order to distinguish the scenarios. Then another thing that we don't know is the absolute scale of the neutrino masses. So we know the mass differences, but we don't know the absolute scale. And another important thing that we don't know is one thing that I mentioned at the beginning. We don't know if neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana particles. And as I said, neutrino oscillations, they cannot distinguish these two scenarios, even if you take into account these meta effects. One can show neutrino oscillations are completely blind to these Majorana phases. There's no way to use neutrino oscillations to distinguish between Dirac and Majorana. However, there is one process that actually can distinguish, and this I want to discuss very briefly now. And this process is called neutrinoless double beta decay. Is called zero nu 2 beta. So what is that? So before we speak about neutrinoless double beta decay, I have to tell you what double beta decay is. Well, that's the decay of some nucleus X, which has set protons and neutrons, which would decay into some other nucleus, which has two more protons and two less neutrons, but spits out two electrons and two electron antineutrinos. There are some nuclei which do that. You need configurations where the single beta decay is for some reason not allowed. So if for some reason the nucleus you would get from a single beta decay is heavier than the one you started off, but the one that you get from a double beta decay is lighter than the traditional one, then this nucleus will do this double beta decay. And there are several examples known. The most important one is germanium 76. There's also, for example, xenon 136. These are nuclei which would do this double beta decay. And so what happens there at the level of the elementary particles, at the quark level, you would have to transform two down quarks, or let's say you have to transform two neutrons into two protons. So you have to transform two down quarks into two up quarks. So that would look something like that. You have a down quark going into an up quark through a weak interaction exchange of a W boson. And then you get an electron and an electron antineutrino. And you simply have to do that two times. You just copy this upper part. That would be the diagram at the quark level where this neutrino is double beta decay process. Now, let's draw it a bit different. Let's put here the antineutrino, and let's put here the electron. Now, if neutrinos are Majorana particles, that means they are their own antiparticles, right? If a Majorana particle means that the charge conjugated version of this particle is the particle itself. And in that case, this electron antineutrino which comes out here is also electron neutrino. So what I can do is just I can combine these two neutrinos which come out here and basically close this fermion line here. So in neutrinos double beta decay, what happens? So I have the same diagram, but the neutrinos close this fermion line here. And if I'm more precise, what will happen here, this will be, of course, instead of the electron neutrino, I will have a sum of the neutrino mass eigenstates running here in this propagator, in this internal propagator. And this only works, so this is the usual two neutrino double beta decay, and this would be the neutrino-less double beta decay. And this only works if neutrinos are Majorana particles. If they are Dirac particles, then I have two electron antineutrinos, and I cannot contract them into a fermion line. So if one observes such a process, this would be a clear proof that neutrinos actually are Majorana particles. Unfortunately, all the experiments that have been running so far didn't observe this process yet. So this process has not been observed yet. So until now, we still don't know if neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana. But as soon as experiments will see such a process, we will be sure that neutrinos are Majorana. If we don't see this process, if experiments don't see the process, you can never be sure if they are Dirac or Majorana. It still could be that this process, for some reason, is strongly suppressed. So what one finds if you compute the amplitude for such a process, this is a bit tricky now, because you probably never have seen a diagram like that. This looks very weird, right? There are two electrons coming out, although there's no defined fermion flow here in this diagram. So this process is actually violates fermion number. So you produce two electrons. So you start with two quarks, you get two quarks in the final state, but you also get two electrons in the final state. So you produce two leptons. You violated not only you violated lepton number, you violated fermion number in this process. And there, in order to compute that, you have to know certain special Feynman rules how to deal with these weird diagrams where you don't have a defined fermion flow. But what one finds is if one does this computation is that such a process will be proportional to the mass of the neutrinos which go through this propagator here. So what one finds is that the amplitude of such a process will be like the sum over the neutrino mass eigenstates with their mass, and then times elements of the PM&S matrix. So those you get from these vertices here. And you will get electron I squared. So the amplitude will be proportional to such a combination of masses and PM&S matrix elements. And it might be the case that for some reason this combination is simply very small. You cannot exclude that. Then you would never see this process, but still the neutrinos could be Majorana particles. Just for some reason, nature was not very kind to us and decided that this combination of parameters was very small. This could happen. On the other hand, if you measure this process, then you will have essentially a measurement of this combination of neutrino parameters. So that will give you a handle on, first of all, on the absolute scale of the neutrino masses. So you will have some measurement, some different combination of the masses, some different independent combination of the mass eigenvalues compared to the oscillations. You will have some handle on the absolute scale of the neutrino masses. And you will also have some additional handle on possible CP phases in the PM&S matrix. So in particular, so here's this expression here. There's just a squared PM&S matrix squared. There's no, instead of PM&S matrix, some PM&S matrix stagger or something like that. So this really is just squared. So it means in that case, these Majorana phases, they don't drop out. So this amplitude really does depend on the Majorana phases. So you would not only have some handle on the overall mass scale, but also some handle on the Majorana phases. You get some constraint on these Majorana phases by measuring this neutrinoless double beta decay. Okay. And actually, it's also sensitive. One can show it's also sensitive to the mass ordering. So you can also actually by measuring this neutrinoless double beta decay process, actually you can also distinguish if you could be able to distinguish if neutrinos have this normal hierarchy or if they have the inverted hierarchy. So you simply get different predictions for this combination given these two different scenarios.
Is there any other known way of being able to distinguish between Dirac and Majorana?
There are some known ways, but they are basically you will never reach the experimental sensitivity to use these other ways. So again, you need some sort of basically you need to invent some process where this part of the diagram appears basically. Because somehow you can contract two neutrinos, that you can be sure that to show that this only works if neutrinos are Majorana. And there are other processes, not only this neutrinos double beta decay, but you can look at certain meson decays or stuff like that. But one can show that you will never have the sensitivity in these other processes to measure that. This is the only process that is known that might have the experimental sensitivity to see it actually. Actually, it's very difficult to measure this thing. So maybe I can just take 2 minutes to explain actually how one would see that. So what one does is one looks at the energy of the electrons which come out from this process. So what one looks is the energy of the two electrons which come out. And then in the case of the usual double beta decay, this will the rate of this process, the rate of the the two neutrino double beta decay, it will actually, I have no idea how it looks exactly, but it will be something like that, I guess. It will have some energy spectrum. And the end point here, the end point of the of the spectrum will be the point where the full energy which you get out of this reaction, so there's basically the mass difference between the original nucleus and the final nucleus, if all this energy goes into the two electrons. In the neutrino-less double beta decay, however, you know from momentum conservation that you only have the electrons. So all the energy you have has to go in the electrons. So in the case of the neutrino-less double beta decay, you expect some small bump here at the end of the spectrum. So what you have to do is basically to measure very precisely this energy spectrum of the electrons which comes out from this double beta decay process, and look at this very precisely at this endpoint, and then you have to hope to see some small bump here of electrons, a small bump of electrons which have exactly this energy, which would be then a signature for this neutrino-less double beta decay process. And yeah, it's simply very difficult because the rate for this process is much, much larger than for this process. The amplitude here is suppressed by neutrino masses. Neutrino masses are extremely tiny, so the probability that this happens compared to probability that this happens is really tiny. So you really have to measure this part of the spectrum extremely precisely in order to be able to discover this process. All right. So that was everything I had about neutrinos. Are there any more questions about neutrinos, or is it more or less clear? Okay, then we go to the second part of the lecture, and this is about the Higgs and the hierarchy problem. So I think yesterday in the afternoon you were calculating a lot about Higgs properties. So you were looking at the decay of the Higgs into various other particles of the standard model, Higgs decaying into fermions, Higgs decaying into gauge bosons. And the standard model is actually very predictive concerning the Higgs. So once you know the Higgs mass, all its properties are completely determined. So you can clearly compute in the standard model what are the branching ratios of the Higgs into certain final states. You can also compute what are the production cross sections of the Higgs. Everything is fixed and can be predicted with very high precision. And all the measurements that have been done with the Higgs up to now, all the measurements of these production cross sections and decays, all those are consistent with the standard model predictions. Nevertheless, when you believe that the Higgs and the existence of the Higgs is actually a strong hint that there should be more than the standard model, that there should be physics beyond the standard model. And I want to, in this last 20 minutes or so, I want to just sketch out the argument why we believe that there should be more than the standard model. So it's kind of an outlook for a course beyond the standard model, I think, which will be given, I think, in a few weeks or a few months, actually. So the Higgs is very unique. So the Higgs is the only scalar particle in the standard model. And the Higgs is only, or the part of the standard model Lagrangian containing the Higgs is the only part which contains an explicit scale. So the Higgs potential, which I write as in the following way, h taker h, so we have a mass term which have a negative sign, and then there's a quartic coupling of the Higgs. And this mass term of the Higgs, this is the only explicit scale which appears in the standard model Lagrangian. All other parameters of the standard model Lagrangian are simply couplings. So for example, here's this quartic coupling, there are the gauge couplings, and there are also the Yukawa couplings. The Higgs mass is the only really massive parameter, the only parameter which has mass dimension 2 in the standard model Lagrangian. That makes it actually very unique and very special. So this mass parameter then sets the scale for all masses of the standard model particles, apart from neutrino masses, which might be due to some other effects. But for the standard model quarks, the gauge bosons and the charged leptons, this Higgs mass parameter is the one that sets the scale for them. Because, well, first of all, if you sit in the minimum of the Higgs potential, the Higgs mass itself will be determined by the Higgs mass parameter. Also, the Higgs VEF will be determined by combination of this mass parameter and the quartic coupling. And because the VEF is determined by this parameter, also all the masses of the other particles are determined by this parameter. And experimentally, we now know that this, the Higgs mass, but this is basically given by this parameter. It's roughly 125 GeV. We have now measured that, so let's put roughly. There's some uncertainty, of course. Now, there is another important scale in particle physics, and this scale is the so-called Planck scale. So the Planck scale has to do with gravity. So the Planck scale is defined as 1 over the square root of the gravitational constant of Newton's constant. This defines a mass scale. And if you put in the gravitational constant, you get that this is something like 10 to 19 GeV. And that's a scale set by gravity. So if you take two particles with that energy, two particles with the energy of 10 to 19 GeV, then this is the energy where the gravitation, the action of these two particles, just the gravitational force between these two particles would be comparable to the other interactions of the standard model, or be comparable then to the strength of the electromagnetics, the weak and the strong interactions. And while the scale of these other interactions is at the level of 100 GeV, the scale of these gravitational interactions at 10 to 19 GeV. So the first naive question one can ask, why is there this huge hierarchy between the scale set by the standard model and the scale set by gravity? So there are 17 orders of magnitude difference. And the question is, one naive question would be, why is there such huge hierarchy? It looks pretty weird why there should be such a tremendous disparity between these two scales. But that's not the weirdest thing. It actually becomes much weirder if we look at it in more detail. And the problem is that once you include quantum corrections to this to the Higgs mass parameter, what one finds, or what one usually says, is that this hierarchy between these two scales is actually not stable against quantum corrections. So what one usually says is that this hierarchy compute one loop corrections to the Higgs mass parameter, you actually would expect it to be much, much larger than this 125 GeV. And I will go through the usual argument, which is very confusing. And when I heard this argument the first time, I was very confused, and I expect also you to be very confused. But nevertheless, let's try to do that. Okay, so let's just calculate the one loop corrections to the Higgs mass. So let's calculate one of the many possible one loop corrections to the Higgs mass in the standard model. And the simplest one would be just coming from the Higgs self interaction. So you have a diagram with the Higgs quartic coupling, and then you just close the loop of two of these legs here, and you would get a correction to the Higgs mass. And we can compute this diagram. I'm not caring about the exact factors of two and so on, just to get the right dependence. And you will have some factor of this quartic coupling up there from the potential. And then you will get a loop integral and then this propagator of the Higgs. Okay, and the usual way to calculate that, well, you can go into, you do spherical coordinates. What you will get is, and you do a weak rotation, or you do a weak rotation to get to Euclidean space, and then do spherical coordinates, you will get something like a lambda. By doing the angular integration, you get a 2 pi squared, so you're left with 8 pi squared, and then an integral from 0 to infinity, the Euclidean version of the momentum. Okay, and that's pretty bad because this is divergent. So we have to do something about it in order to evaluate it. I think in the lecture you often used dimensional regularization. So you didn't evaluate this integral in 4 dimensions, but in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, and then got poles in 1 over epsilon. What I want to do here now is something slightly different. I will use a different type of regularization. Instead of going to d minus epsilon dimensions, I will just not integrate until infinity, but I will say I introduce some cutoff regulator. So instead of integrating until infinity, I will integrate until some large momentum lambda. So instead of integrating infinity, I integrate until lambda. And then I can simply integrate this expression here. And what one finds is that this is I lambda over 16 pi squared, and then a lambda squared plus a term which goes with the Higgs mass and log Higgs mass over lambda squared. And this is already written as an expansion in Higgs mass over this large momentum scale lambda. So there will be more terms of order Higgs mass to the 4 over lambda squared, and so on. Okay. That means that this expression here now, this has mass dimension 2, and you can convince yourself that this actually, you can interpret that you can see that as a correction to the Higgs mass. So the Higgs mass squared won't be only given by its tree-level value, the parameter in the potential, but you will have these one-loop corrections. You will have a correction going as I lambda, or not I lambda, lambda over 16 pi squared times. In particular, you will get this lambda squared, this huge momentum, this huge arbitrary momentum that I use to regulate the loop integral. And you can do other diagrams. So this comes from this Higgs loop. You can do other diagrams. You can do loops, for example, with a W boson. This will give another contribution, which goes as the coupling constant squared over 16 pi squared, again, times this cutoff, this momentum cutoff. You can also get corrections from fermion loops. In particular, the top loop is the most important one because the top has the largest Yukawa coupling, the largest coupling here. This will give you a minus 3 over 8 pi squared top Yukawa squared, again, times the momentum cutoff. And then you can continue. You can add loops of all the other standard model particles, and you will get additional corrections to the Higgs mass. Now the question here is now what is this lambda, what is this cutoff, what is the physical interpretation of this cutoff? And the usual thing that one says in that context is that, well, this lambda should correspond somehow to the scale until which the standard model is valid. So if you do a standard model computation, you should be integrating your loop momenta until the scale, until the standard model is valid. If at some point the standard model breaks down, if something else is coming in at that scale, things might change, the propagators might change, the new theory will come in. You don't know exactly what's going on there, so maybe you should stop at the scale where the standard model ends to be valid. So lambda should be somehow the scale until which the standard model is valid. Now we know that the standard model cannot be the full description of nature. The standard model itself doesn't contain gravity. So we know that there is an upper bound on this scale lambda. The scale lambda can be at most as large as the Planck scale. This is the scale where gravity comes in, and that's the latest at that scale, the standard model will have to be modified. So will have to be replaced by some form of some theory which contains a quantum description of gravity, which contains quantum gravity. So we know that this lambda should be below the Planck scale, or at most at the Planck scale. But the Planck scale is dramatically more massive than the scale in the standard model, in particular, much more massive than the Higgs mass. So if you just take this lambda and put in the Planck mass up there, you will get huge corrections to the Higgs mass. So in order to get now your 125 Higgs mass, you would need to adjust your bare Higgs mass, the tree-level Higgs mass, this mu h squared there, such that it actually cancels all these loop corrections, these incredibly large loop corrections. So you would need to adjust this tree-level Higgs mass plus these quantum corrections, plus these, I write it as 1 over 16 pi squared lambda squared. You would have to adjust these two terms at the level of basically 32 or 34 orders of magnitude in order to have an exact cancellation, and you're only left with something which is approximately 125 GeV squared. And this is not only true if I put lambda to the Planck mass, but there are many orders of magnitude between them. So as long as this lambda is much, much bigger than the scale of the standard model, as long as this is true, I will have a tremendous amount of fine-tuning between this tree-level mass and the quantum corrections in order to get the 125 out. And this is what is usually referred to as the hierarchy problem. So not only the fact that there is this large hierarchy, but also that this large hierarchy is not stable, that as soon as you introduce such a large hierarchy, the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass, they want to drag up the Higgs mass to this other very high energy scale. So whatever new high energy scale there is in nature, these quantum corrections, they try to push the Higgs mass up to this high energy scale. And the standard model itself doesn't have any mechanism to protect the Higgs mass from these very large quantum corrections. And this argument should confuse you, I guess. I hope at least it confuses you, because you should have learned that the standard model is a renormalizable quantum field theory. So what I was talking here about this cutoff regularizations and these divergences, these quadratically divergent parts, which have this lambda squared dependence, you can simply say, why should I care about that? In principle, you can define a counter term, right? You should define a counter term for the Higgs mass and just simply absorb these divergences into the Higgs mass, into this counter term for the Higgs mass, so that all these lambda squared terms should not appear actually there, right? You can just absorb them into some counter term. And this is maybe even more confusing actually if you don't do this computation in in with this cutoff regulator, but if you use dimensional regularization as you used to do it. So if I now calculate the same diagram in dimensional regularization, again same story as before. What one gets now instead of doing this, instead of introducing the cutoff, instead of integrating from zero to lambda, I go into d minus epsilon dimensions, and what you find then is that this diagram doesn't look very badly behaved. It will be proportional to the Higgs mass squared actually, and then it will have some 2 over epsilon plus log Higgs mass squared over some parameterization scale squared, and then there's a plus 1 here also. If you do that in a dimensional regularization, this diagram becomes simply that. You will get your 1 over epsilon pole. There's no large Planck mass anywhere appearing. There's just this 1 over epsilon, and you have a Higgs mass. So this doesn't look bad at all. The way you would continue now from here is you would write down some parameterization constant for the Higgs mass. You would absorb the 1 over epsilon pole into this parameterization constant. You can even calculate the running of the Higgs mass if you want. You can compute a parameterization group equation for the Higgs mass. You will get, if you want, a beta function for the Higgs mass. So that doesn't look badly behaved at all, though. So there is a hierarchy problem now. There's no large scale entering here anywhere. It doesn't seem at all that there is some problem there. I don't have to do any fine tuning. I just reabsorb the 1 over epsilon divergence into a counter term. And this is actually true. So if you look at the standard model itself, the standard model itself, if you want, actually doesn't have a hierarchy problem. So hierarchy problem only arises if you extend the standard model to include some new heavy physics. So if you if I write it down, the standard model itself has no hierarchy problem. And indeed, if you look at the standard model itself, it only contains one scale, right? So there's only one scale in the standard model. There is no other scale in the standard model. There is no hierarchy in the standard model itself, which could be subject to any quantum corrections, which would make two scales look similar, because there are no two scales in the standard model. The standard model itself only contains one scale. So you only get the hierarchy problem if you extend the standard model by something else. But we are pretty sure that we should extend the standard model by something else, at least to include gravity. We know that there is gravity, and gravity has a scale. It has a Planck scale. So at the Planck scale, you should extend the standard model with some sort of quantum gravity theory. So we know that one has to extend the standard model because of gravity. There might be things like grand unified theories. Maybe, I don't know if you learned about in this course about gauge coupling unification. So there are hints that the gauge coupling actually unify at some very high energy scale. In this very high energy scale, there's a new gauge group, a grand unified gauge group, SU5 or SU10 or something like that. And in that theory, there would be a lot of new physics up this very high energy scale, at the energy scale where these gut symmetry is unbroken. And there again, you would have some extension of the standard model, which new physics at some very high scale. Another thing you know about are right-handed neutrinos. So there might be very heavy right-handed neutrinos, which by the CSUN mechanism gives some sort of explanation why the neutrino masses that we observe are very tiny. So that there will also be an extension of the standard model by some heavy new physics. And whenever you do something like that, then actually you do induce a hierarchy problem. So if you go to any of these theories, if you introduce right-handed neutrinos, so actually now you can compute loops, loop corrections to the Higgs mass, which contain these right-handed neutrinos. Then you will find that you will get corrections to the Higgs mass, which are proportional to the mass of these right-handed neutrinos. If you have some gut theory and some very heavy gauge bosons, extremely heavy gauge bosons, which are heavy, I don't know, 10 to 15 GeV, masses. You might have, or you will have, at some level loop corrections of Higgs mass which contain these very heavy gauge bosons, then you will get corrections of Higgs mass which are as large as the masses of these gauge bosons. And if you have gravity, if you have gravity, some, if you invent some form of quantum gravity which is consistent, and if you add this to the standard model, you very likely will have some corrections to the Higgs mass, which will contain with some new physics, which will contain some new physics, which is which has mass scales of the Planck mass, which will correct the Higgs mass by an amount which is proportional to the Planck mass. So just to give you the very simplest example of some new physics, which would give you a hierarchy problem. So if you just add, oh, by the way, I'm going over a few minutes. Is that okay, or you have to leave immediately, or what is the situation?
A few minutes
is okay. Okay, yep. So I need 2 minutes, probably 3 minutes. So if I add to the standard model a scalar field, which happens to have a mass of the order of the Planck mass. So maybe in some form of quantum gravity theory, some of these, one of these scalars appears for some reason. So I add to my standard model Lagrangian a term Planck mass squared, scalar, like a scalar, plus some quartic coupling of the scalar with the Higgs. Scalar, like a scalar, Higgs, dagger, Higgs. And then I will get a one loop correction to the Higgs mass from the scalar, which will be proportional, completely analogous to the expression that I wrote here, which will be proportional to the to this quartic coupling. And then I will get actually now the mass of the scalar running in this loop. So this will be the Planck mass squared. And then, well, I will get this epsilon pole plus the log and again, you would, I don't know if you can see that. So this one of epsilon pole, you again, you would renormalize away. You would put some counter term which removes this one of epsilon pole, but you're still left with these other terms here, and they're proportional to the Planck mass, to the, they're proportional to the mass of the scalar running here. So you will get a correction to the Higgs mass, which is of the order of the Planck mass, and then you run into this hierarchy problem. Yes.
Contribution like of the mass of the top quark square, would that be a problem?
You mean
the loop with that? I think
I
showed some loop out there, yes.
Yeah, the
top loop.
But if we do it with dimensional regularization, it seems that there's no problem because it's just like here, the mass of the Higgs square. But
yep.
Here it's a problem because it's the mass of Planck square.
Right.
So if it's the mass of the top square, so it's just standard model, wouldn't it also be a problem because it's to be compared with mass of
the Higgs? But the top mass is not much larger than the Higgs mass, so you wouldn't call this a big problem.
Okay.
I mean, it's, no, there. I mean.
So we just consider it a problem when it's the order of Planck mass, but not it's as big.
It's in the end, this becomes a matter of personal taste to some extent. So when is it too large and when not?
So the point is that in order to avoid this problem. So yeah, typically you would say, you would expect these things, you would expect that there's stuff at the Planck scale because of quantum gravity. And whatever there is, it should give you corrections of the Planck mass, of the order Planck mass squared. So this is definitely a problem. Then if other things also make problems, it can be. If they're heavy right in the neutrinos, they could make problems. They might not, we don't know. But the thing is that in order to avoid these problems, what one then does is, or one very popular thing that one does is to introduce a new symmetry, which is called supersymmetry. And one of the features is that it introduces, if you implement supersymmetry into the standard model, one thing that one gets is that for every standard model particle, you will have a superpartner. And then the superpartner will exactly cancel the loop of the standard model particle to the Higgs mass. So you will have an exact cancellation. There won't be any of these corrections to the Higgs mass left. The only correction to the Higgs mass to the level that the supersymmetry is not exact. So if supersymmetry would be exact, so for example, there would be a partner to the top, so called the stop. And which if supersymmetry is exact, it would have the same mass as the top, and then the top loop and the stop loop would exactly cancel each other. However, we haven't observed any partner of the top which would have the same mass as the top. So there is nothing like that we would have observed. So we know that the stop has to be heavier than the top. So what you then find is that the correction of the Higgs mass, which is left over, is actually of the order of the stop mass, the mass of the stop. And then one is searching for these stops at the LHC, for example, and there are bounds now that say that the stop has to be heavier than roughly, let's say, 500 GeV or 600 or 700 GeV, and these bounds will keep getting stronger and stronger the longer the LHC runs. So at some point, you will ask the question, okay, now I have this stop in my theory, which has 1 TeV, maybe. Is that already a problem? Is this correction too large already, or is it not too large? And then it becomes a matter of taste, to which extent you believe that there should be this stop, if this stop is still solving the hierarchy problem, if it's so heavy, and at which point should I stop to search for it, and venture things that this is maybe not the solution to the problem. Okay, I guess that's a good point to stop. Any more questions? Okay, all right, thanks.